Blog Talk Radio.
I am a young patriot, I struggle for right. Not for security alone do I fight, but the freedom to be whatever you might be. If we live in socialism and not slavery, I am a young patriot and I have a creed. I believe in others cause we have believed. Not in the rights of rulers, but humanity. To be healthy and happy and to be free. I'm a young patriot, a term I define. Not a matter of age, but a state of mind. And if you love freedom for liberty, you care. Join the young patriots and fight for it there. Yeah, join the young patriots and fight for it there.
Good evening, this is Zach Henson, and welcome to When the World is on Fire, Episode 5, the official podcast of the Young Patriots Organization. We're coming to you live from Montgomery, Alabama. I have moved, y'all. I have moved from Birmingham to Montgomery. My wife got a good job here in Montgomery. And as I've been telling people, I'm a real go-getter. I take my wife to work, and then I go get her. So I hope y'all are all doing well. You know, one of the things that about Montgomery is that it's the home of Hank Williams. And the title of our podcast, When the World is on Fire, is from an old Hank Williams song. So one of the first things I did when I got here was go by the Hank Williams Museum. I bought a Hank Williams hat, and, you know, it was really tragic. He died when he was, I think, 29 years old, and he had heart failure and back problems, and I think he may have had Marfan syndrome, too. So he was really not doing well, and he died of a heart attack at 29. So it's really tragic. Life cut short, and He is a legend in the country music world. He basically founded the genre of outlaw country and is a hero to many. It's really interesting if you go down the main little drag here in Montgomery. The Hank Williams Museum is right next to the EJI. The EJI offices, the Equal Justice Initiative offices, who have the Equal Justice Initiative, who have the Legacy Memorial, and it sort of shows you some of the history of Montgomery in the sense that you have the white working class history and then you have the civil rights history here. It's a little bit different from Birmingham. There's not a whole lot of white working class history, and I'm still just kind of exploring that and trying to see what Montgomery's all about and seeing where the fissures and tensions and conflicts are. It's been a really interesting month. Like I said, we moved. We got a house here in Montgomery. And things are changing. I'm going to be, hopefully, later on this month, I'll be doing some talks around the state of Alabama, doing some music and some talks around the state of Alabama. So hopefully y'all be able to come see us. We don't have dates yet. I know for a fact that August 10th at our house here in Montgomery, we're going to have a little talk. We're going to do a little talk at the house and kind of a housewarming party, so maybe some of our folks will be able to come see us there. I'm really going to miss Birmingham. I'm really proud of the work that we've done there. But I kind of feel like it's time to move on to other types of endeavors and try some different types of stuff in my life. So the world is on fire. We have a crazy fascist, orange fascist president who's further separating children at the border. We have rising fascist threat all over the country, emboldened fascists. And, you know, I think many of us thought that we had defeated fascism in the 20th century, but it's coming back rearing its ugly head. And a lot of what we do here on When the World is on Fire is talk about how do we fight fascism, what's the best way to fight fascism. And so on the line, is this Jay Carrico on the line?
It is. Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you doing? Today we have J.M. Carrico, who's an Antifa organizer in Tennessee. They're also running for Senate in Tennessee, so in a sort of platform miking type of Senate run. And Jay, could you tell us a little bit about Antifa and tell us about some of the type of work that you've been doing with Antifa over the past couple of years?
Sure. Well, primarily my involvement in Antifa has been in, community defense at events and doxing of hate groups and researching hate groups and infiltrating hate groups. Those are the tactics that I've used mostly. Somewhat also lampooning, heckling, just engaging with and trying to undermine the ideology of some of the alt-right or what used to be called identitarians or what can rightly be called Nazis for the most part. So I think the anti-fascist movement has been around since the 1930s and 20s, since fascism started, and they've used tactics ranging from street fights to putting up flyers in neighborhoods to let people know that they're not, that they're racist in their area. And that's taken on many different iterations, whether it be Redneck Revolt or the Anti-Racist Action Network. There's many different anti-fascists out there, and I got involved through one people's project with Daryl Lamont Jenkins.
Cool, that's really interesting. I've been following some of your stuff on Facebook, and I think people don't have a really good idea about what Antifa is, and some of our listeners may wonder what exactly it is. I think some people think it's an organization. Some people think it's just a bunch of street thugs. Could you give us an idea about what Antifa actually is?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a loosely organized, I mean, it's well organized. I don't mean to say that loosely. It's a loosely associated networks of decentralized network of autonomous groups that are people who just have a sense that things have gotten too bad, or that there's Nazis around, or that, you know, any number of things that calls them to act upon their conscience. And they do that, and they use their skills that they may have acquired in other areas to apply towards basically community defense, essentially, is the overall the goal of anti-fascism, I think, is community defense against the far right racist factions. I think
cool.
that's primarily what we do, and that can take many different forms.
And I think you know, we talk a lot on this podcast about anti-fascist work, and a lot of the folks that we have talked about, guests that have come on and have done anti-fascist work, are doing a lot more sort of community organizing. You know, educating people about why fascism arises, where it comes from, and the type of you know, the type of ways to counter that in your own communities and maybe in a more indirect way than the way that Antifa and yourself have done it in the past. Can you talk about why it is also important to confront fascism in a direct way and in the way that you have done your work?
Sure. I think education is a really important part of defense. I think that, you know, feeding people, with the access that individuals might have is an important part of community defense even. But I think that the kind that we do, the direct kind, is just it's a way of, you know, in many ways, a soft target presents an open opportunity for fascists and people who buy into the ideology to act, right, at events. And if there's a presence of people who are willing to stop that, we can show that you don't have to rely on the state for that. Because the state isn't in our interests, but if people of good conscience want to defend their community, that is in our interests. And I think that by doing it directly, we show that we're capable of doing so. And if nothing else, then that's something. But I think even more so than that, it's, you know, these are real threats. We saw that in Charlottesville. We've seen that over and over and over again. And but I think that we also need to tie into the prison industrial complex and tie it into the military industrial complex, because there's elements of direct and indirect fascism within those situations as well. So I don't think that just the LARPers on the street or just the people who have connections to, you know, Dugin or just the people who are, you know, KKK wearing, like, those people in office who would never, you know, associate with those people but continue to perpetuate systems that, you know, do the exact same things that those people would want, you know?
And I will say that I have watched your work and others with Antifa, and y'all have to a great degree deplatformed many, and I think many of the fascists like Richard Spencer and others have said that Antifa has been very successful in deplatforming Nazis. And I think it's important for people to understand that, you know, I've always said that to confront the fascist threat, we need a by any and all means necessary approach, which means everything from bland liberal reform to directly confronting fascists where they are speaking, and everything in between. I think there's a lot of infighting within leftist circles, and, you know, I think one of the things that I've seen recently is a takedown of Ocasio-Cortez for, you know, being a sellout or whatever. And, you know, I think we need to understand that type of electoral strategy is as much a part of anti-fascism as direct confrontation everywhere. Wait, could you comment on that, on electoral strategy?
Yeah, certainly. Sure. So I think that anything you give the state, it can use against you. That's important to remember in any sort of engagement with electoral politics, right? But there's not really a platform that exists to engage with the political mass other than electoral politics, right? So it's like a catch-22, right? In order to get the word out about what we're talking about and to even move the barometer in any direction, we're going to have to engage with electoral politics. But we have to do so, I think, knowing in a certain extent that electoral politics and reform are not ever going to get what we need to get done, because our economic system and because of international economic systems and geopolitics, it's just that we have to build something else that is basically a canopy for the collapse of this current system. So working within the system, people are wanting to do that and stuff like that. I think it's a worthwhile endeavor, but you have to know the limitations within which you're working at the time of engaging with it. Otherwise, it's really easy probably to be, you know, bought out, you know, essentially, if you don't have the convictions. That's what people are worried about. And I think that, for instance, with Chelsea Manning, right, I think people were a little leery when she join the Democratic Party instead of just going independent. I mean, but I mean that's a move that people that they made, and I think that she had 8 years of being in a really horrible situation and came out as one of the most popular political figures, you know. And so that's a lot of like stress on somebody and a lot of like attention on somebody, a magnifying glass on somebody who's essentially a brand new organizer, right? And they're coming in, they're making mistakes that maybe all of us might have made back in the day, you know, but that if we were put under a microscope might have been seen as something, you know, meeting with the people or whatever. I think that a lot of people have questioned her motives, but I think that she's very brave for stepping up as a person who has that magnifying glass on them and is willing to put their experiences to public, you know, offering, you know, to be able to like say, hey, I want to change things in the best way I know how and the best way I can, and use that fame, whether or not they want it or not, to build towards revolution, build towards an. But I think that we, again, you have to be careful that we're not letting the state co-opt revolutionary lingo. And like, for instance, the Democracy at Work bill that Bernie just put out. What is democracy at work exactly? Does it mean? And I mean, I don't want to go off subject, but I think that, politics has their limits.
This is a free form podcast. Feel free to go off subject and talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Well, it just is, for instance, when I think about democracy at work, I don't think about like a copy of the representative democratic structure that we have in America, right? Like where we have like these people who we legislate to basically make our decisions for us. I think of like it as being we decide where the profits go, right? I feel like the labor discussion in America in general is very stagnant. And we need ideas that are like, minimum wage is great and a living wage would be awesome, but like, what about a ratio? You know, like, what if we had
what do you mean by a ratio?
Everybody gets a raise.
What do you mean by a ratio?
Yeah, like, I think that if everybody, profits go up when everybody gets a raise, or when profits go up, everybody gets a raise, that's a pretty good start. I mean, it's obviously not the revolutionary, the most, you know, but it's something that would be clearly good. And again, like, I'm not trying to say that there's not things we should do and engage with in political. I mean, it takes 15 minutes to vote, you know what I'm saying? So why not? You know, but what else are you going to do outside the ballot box? And how can we get democracy outside the ballot box is really the question, you know? But as far as the pay ratio goes, I think that it's worked in other places, you know? So, I mean, why not push for it? But how much energy are you putting into the state, and how much energy are you putting into finding answers that may render the state arbitrary? So, like, does the state, like taxes, for instance, that's like buying in bulk to save money for things we need. But
sure,
if it's going to like the military and to pharmaceutical industries and to corporate welfare, then it's not really doing that. And so it's kind of a theft, you know, it's like libertarians say, right? And like, so there is that nuance, right? And I think that like, that's really where the onus on authority lies, is to give back more than it takes. And in any situation, we can ask that. And then see, does it can be used against us? So when you said earlier, for instance, about reform to be like used against Nazis, it can be very, very difficult. So like free speech, for instance, the state shouldn't crack down on people's free speech. But that doesn't mean concerned citizens shouldn't crack down on organizing against for genocide, right? Like,
sure,
there's a nuance there. And I think that it's like, yeah, call the police if that's the only option you have, and there's like, you know, your kid's been kidnapped, or like you don't have the way of like, you know, so you've been raped or something of that nature. Yes, call the police. Fight for legislation to get some rape to get tested. Fight for legislation that does those kind of things. Of course. But like at the same time, what can we do to make it to where those institutions aren't based on protecting private property more so than protecting human beings, you know? What can we do to make it so that the people who are calling for guns to be used against tyranny, but then they don't realize that there's tyranny going on against people of color every day, you know? What? How can we create situations that?
So I this is an interesting conversation about, and I think Ashley Woodard Henderson, the co-executive director of Hollander, posted this. I think it was yesterday, and she said there's government in the United States, which democracy is aspirational at best, and that's getting people elected. And then there's governance, which is sort of this idea of organizing for each of our individual collective freedoms. And you have to do both, but really the primary goal is for the collective freedom part. And for me, when I think about engaging with the state, I think about, like, how can we engage with the state in a way that is going to – are there policies or can we pass policies at the state level that will be able to cede power to the people? And I don't know if anybody's ever really even tried to do that, because a lot of the reforms they as you have suggested, they reinforce the power of the state. So, right, like if you're engaging with the state about policing and the state says, we'll give you body cameras. Well, if you get body cameras, that's going to reinforce the power of the state. But if you were to be able to get, say, a civilian oversight board with real legal power, then that would be able to cede some power to the people and away from the state. Do you think that
as long as that civilian oversight committee is staffed by people with people that actual communities who are the most marginalized and affected by police brutality get to elect?
Sure. Yeah, I agree. So we've been talking about this, and it's sort of interesting because you are running a Senate campaign. Can you talk a little bit about your Senate campaign? Tell us what your platform is. Tell us why you're running. Tell us what you're going to do when you win. And give us an idea what it's all about.
All right. So essentially, it's a the idea is that to get the idea out there, to get the ideas that the working class interests are aligned across the globe. So, that there are certain institutions that seek to take what we naturally would do with our communities and filter that upwards into profits for very few who can control all the resources. And I think that most of us agree with some level of that, right? And but we're divided by so many things, and historically oppressed in many communities. And I think that what this campaign really wants to emphasize and point out and put forward is the idea that can we create in our neighborhoods places that give us more community than Facebook, give us more security than the police, give us more value than our minimum wage jobs, give us more sustenance and sustainability than a grocery store. Can we create that in our communities, and have we done that before? What models can we use that we're already doing, that we're already engaged in, to network around, to build those kind of things in a street by street, to make the current structures obsolete, or to at least build a canopy for when those structures do collapse, right? Or at least to build some sort of transfer system for people who may, you know, not be seen as legal under a fascist system, or whatever specific problem might come up under the, that we can't, that the state is, unable to engage with. How can we, create networks that are networking all of the already great work that's being done? And that's really what this campaign is about, is just promoting the great work that's already being done. Saying, like, we already have the solutions. We just need to network them into an organized model that can – there's this great new book called Emergent Strategy that I would definitely recommend people checking that out.
Who's the author?
And I believe their name is Adrienne Marie Brown.
Okay.
But I might be mistaken. I think that the IRPGF, for instance, the International Revolutionary People's Guerrilla Forces, they're a group that's talking about communalization projects Their model is based on Rojava. We take a lot of inspiration from Chiapas and the Izalin movement, and just trying to figure out how we can create a systemic kind of, not systemic, but systematic network of sustainable autonomous communities capable of, you know, defense, but also education and you know, and ability to like really just create something new in the shell of the old and do it in a timely manner because of environmental reasons and because of, and I really want to, in this campaign, I just want to get more people who are of a leftist bent, who have these ideas, who have these kind of things that we believe that we can network outside of the system to engage with that. It's not so much that I necessarily want people to vote for me, which would be cool, I guess, but like it's more so what are you going to do outside of voting to engage with things in a way that takes power outside of the ballot box. It takes power outside of the hands of the corporate elite and their cronies in the state, you know? I do have a platform, though, and if I did win, I would try to, as much as possible, give as much legislative control to the most marginalized communities as possible who are most affected by the legislation and get them to, and get those people to write their own legislation for their own and pass that, you know, basically, and be just a representative of the people, actually, you know.
Imagine that. Go ahead.
But yeah, no, that's about. I mean, if you want to look at my platform, I have a 35-point platform. I think at this point, it's just, you know, pretty much any good, great leftist idea I hear, or you know, idea that seems liberatory, definitely the movement for Black Lives platform. I definitely want to promote all of that, and I think that there's certainly, you know, other excellent organizations. A lot of the Green Party stuff is great. I mean, it's not there's stuff that we can do. I think that we should, for instance, critical careers like teaching and medical personnel, they should be given, just like the military, they should be paid to go to school. You know, we need those careers, right? And then they need to be given housing in critical areas so that people don't have to go necessarily to a hospital or a doctor's office where they're gonna, like, they can be right there in their neighborhood for certain people, you know? There's, you know, these kind of things that we could do. I think it's strange that we see police surveil populations and stuff, but we never see that with ambulance or fire trucks. And I'm not saying that we should. I'm just saying that, like, it's just a very interesting concept, and I think that's something to look into as far as, like, is that gas money and, you know, like, all that stuff, is that worth something? Is that something we need to put up legislation about, you know, surveillance of certain neighborhoods for sure. I think there's we need to get a legislation to test every single rape kit that's ever put forward. The 1 out of 10 rape kits don't get put forward, don't get tested. We need to, I would like to see a, I have an idea for a kind of a lampooning kind of a strategy wherein I put forth a workers' vacation week, because a CEO makes, you know, 500 times the amount of his lowest paid employee. Why can't 500 of his employees then take a vacation at once? If he's, it shouldn't be, if, and I did, just by presenting that to the public, it kind of shows the absurdity of the pay levels, you know? And obviously it wouldn't get through, but just by putting that out as legislation, I think that it would make a point.
Go ahead. Keep going.
No, go ahead. Sorry. No, you go.
So I wanted to say I didn't know a whole lot about you when I invited you on our show, but there's a deep strain of commitment to humanity, as well as a sense of like playfulness and joy in the way that you talk about the work that you do and the way that you engage. And I really, really appreciate that. And could you talk about, you know, maybe some of your moral and philosophical commitments as to why you engage the way you do, and why, you know, you believe in people. Like, clearly, like, you want communities to get together and provide for themselves. And some people would say that's ridiculously utopian. I wouldn't say that, but some people would say that. But the reason that you say that is because it seems that you have, like, a really profound commitment to everyday people. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why you have that sort of commitment.
Well, thank you. That's really kind, though, to say. I think that, you know, people go through different spirals in their lives. You know, people go through different, whatever you want to call it, processes, in which you would see them in that moment and you'd be like, well, this person's clearly engaging in some really shitty decision making, right? And then, but if you saw them in a different period of your life, you'd be like, this person's really on it, right? And I think that's us too, right? That's everybody. That's anybody, you know. And I think that's a lot to do with the environment that people are in and the stresses that people are under. People can, like, be capable of some of the most profound, beautiful acts and some of the most ugly, horrendous things, you know. And it's it's just so interesting just how people, just a little bit of kindness and a little bit of, like, you know, belief and positivity and motivation can change people's how entire outlook on life, you know. I think that our jobs don't motivate us to engage in a way that's productive, because what do we really get from working for somebody who makes more off of our labor than we do? Obviously, alienation, as Marx talks about. I mean, but, like, you know, voting obviously doesn't do much. It doesn't seem like, at least. So we don't really feel motivated in that. There's just not a lot of stuff where we pursue our passion and get something out of it other than shame, you know. And so I feel like if we can find out what people are passionate about and find out what people are led by, there's a place for that in liberationary struggle. And we don't even have to talk about it in that language. If we provide the thing, then people will see that it works, and then they'll engage with it. And I think that, you know, I was adopted at a really young age, and I knew, like, it was a disparity. Like, there was a big disparity between what I come from and where I was. Like, my adopted parents were upper middle class, and I was living in a car before I was adopted, right? But it was I was adopted by my biological aunt, so I was still in the family. And just seeing friends of mine, the difference in, you know, our parents' work ethic was minimal, at anything, you know. There was not really much of a difference in that. As a matter of fact, it seemed as if a lot of people had more, you know, worked a lot harder, you know, and had a lot less. And so I started to see that as a young person, and started to realize that, like, a lot of depth of character isn't in people who never had to suffer. Like, that's kind of the spiritual so to get more into, like, the philosophical ideal of why do I do, it's like, so I grew up conservative fundamentalist Christian, right? But I came out of that probably about 16, 17, became more of a, you know, left liberal Christian, you know, and then finally kind of a Christian anarchist. And then now I'm more of a, you know, I don't necessarily believe in the literal structure of the story, but I see it as like a movement that came out of Jewish liberation from Rome, right? And the culture that it came from, it seems like that it was a message of that it's about the fact that, you know, transformation and almost doubt, you know, to a certain extent, is the key to changing oneself. And in that, the changing of society comes from looking at how those power systems work with inside and with and outside of us, and then questioning those power systems. And so I still have inspiration from that. But I've always studied philosophy since I was probably about 12, and you know, always enjoyed, you know, philosophical conversation and stuff like that. And that's how I probably got involved in anarchism, was just talking to people about philosophy. And
it's interesting. I think we've talked about this before. I also grew up in the Church of Christ. I think you said you grew up in the Church of Christ. I also grew up in the Church of Christ. When I was 16 years old, I was more or less asked to leave the church. I think one of the things that bothers me the most about today's movement is ideological fundamentalism from a lot of different, you know, corners of the movement in the understanding, very much like Christian fundamentalism, that the belief system is what will save us, when in reality what will save us is real human connection. Could you comment maybe on some of the fundamentalism, how you feel about maybe some of the fundamentalism of the movement?
Sure. I've said before, I think it's like we see the meme, right? We internalize it. We see it from on high, right? Facebook. It just comes on our timeline. Nobody's calling us out. You know what I'm saying? We just see it. And then we're like, oh, shit, you know, that's right. I've done that before. Oh, crap, I should probably, yeah, now I'm gonna alter my actions, or I'm going to change my, and that's all well and good. And then we go into the comment section for other comments, and we make sure that somebody see that meme, right? And we feel good because we like it to tell somebody else and put ourselves on a platform, right? And then if that person doesn't immediately, you know, internalize it and do what we did when we saw it come from the timeline, they're seeing it come from, a person who, you know, is just as flawed as they are, you know. And then we, you know, immediately shame them to the point where, like, it becomes about them being, you know, ostracized, and they're, like, you know, acting very much in defensive. And that just seems like, there's been really wonderful people in my life who've called me out in really beautiful ways, right? And it's helped me grow. Now, I'm the kind of person who's gonna, like, I don't think I was ever my parents always called me out for shit, you know, and I had to kind of like get a tough skin about that shit and be like, okay, cool, how can I grow from this, right? And that's how I look at things, right? That's me personally. But people early on don't always do that, right? And I think that if you show up at a church and you're wearing a Marilyn Manson T-shirt, a lot of churches will be like, "Hey, come on in," right? But if you show up at a leftist event with a NASCAR hat on, you might get a lot of sideways looks, right?
Right.
And that's like, I think that there is kind of an elitism and a pharisaicalism, because like a lot of people haven't had a chance to study a lot of ideology, and they don't even think about certain things, and that's privilege, right? That's 100% privilege a lot of times. But then there's people who don't have those privileges, who I've seen, you know, in different communities who don't know about certain things. It's not like, and like, I just know there's some people who don't do anything but sit behind a keyboard, who would go into that community that needs help, and it's like, and like, or needs solidarity, you know. And would like just be like, well, they did this, and like you'd be like, well, how can we be pragmatic and work with people, you know, who don't understand that, who don't necessarily, not that they couldn't understand the ideology or anything, but they just haven't ever been, you know, interested in engaging with political theory, you know.
They may have been too busy putting food on the table.
Exactly. And so that's like, and I just feel like that there's a lot of that, and you kind of have to, like, I think that those of us who've been engaged in the work for a long time realize that a lot of people who talk like, who do a lot of those things, are just virtue signaling, if that's the word, I think. They're just being like, oh, I did my good work for the week by calling out some people who said something that's like, that I've recently found out was problematic, right? Like, you know, like, and it's not so much that we shouldn't call, I mean, it's not so much that we shouldn't call people's negative behavior by any means, but it's like, are you doing it because you want to better that person, or are you doing it because you want to look better than that person, right? And like, and so are you doing it because you want to protect your friends who are marginalized, or are you doing it because you want to marginalize that person into not ever being part of the movement again, right? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
You know, I think it's bullshit to say that that the left, like, pushed people into the alt-right, but we definitely pushed people away from acting in leftist circles.
So when I was talking to you about this podcast, I asked you what you wanted to talk about, and one of the things you said was language and myth. And we got about 20 minutes left, and I have one question that I ask everyone at about 10 minutes to finish up. But I want to give you the floor for the next 10 minutes to say whatever you want to talk about, and for us to have a conversation about language and myth, because I think those things are actually very important.
Yeah, language is so for instance, if you use the word union in the South, you get a lot of sideways looks. But if you say democracy at work or participatory economics, you come off somebody's radar and doesn't get that Pavlovian trigger response, right? And so like everybody has different associations to different words. Love to one person is going to mean something totally different. You know, people just have certain versions of certain words, Christianity, you know, these kind of things. There's understandable reasons for all that, you know, and it's a very individual case. Language is very malleable, you know. So I think that, we all have myths too, right? We all have certain stories that we tell ourselves. In order to almost narrow down the events and stimuli that actually acted upon our engagement, you know, like and so I think that it's extremely interesting. I know this may be a little bit off subject, but like there was a book written in 1902. I was listening to this podcast the other week, and they're talking about how this book was written in 1902, talking about this ocean liner or whatever. That crashed into an iceberg, right? And then, of course, in 1917, we have the Titanic. And it's not so much that it's like prophetic or anything. It's just that the reason that we know about the Titanic and remember it is because it has everything. It has class, it has romance, it has struggle, it has all these different things, propensity for that, right, inside of that story, right?
Yeah.
And it was basically, the main thing about it was that mankind thought they could outdo nature, essentially, and that eventually it was just inevitable, you know. And so that's the reason it was able to be written before it happened. It was inevitable. And I think that, so going back to language, is that like, I think that it's almost inevitable we're gonna have to change our language in some way or another to be able to overcome. Whenever you have a religious experience, when you do mushrooms, or when you have something that really changes your core, you're changing your language system to a certain extent.
Sure.
You're changing the way your story works, right? How are we going to do that as a culture, I guess?
Yeah, how are we going to do mushrooms as a culture? I think that's a great idea. I think one of the things that one of my mentor, who is going to be the next guest next month, Carolyn Finney, what she does with language is she takes a word that everybody knows that may have a fluid meaning, and she twists it just a little bit to make it mean something a bit different. So we talk, like, this is her theory, this is Carolyn Finney's theory, this is not my theory, and we'll talk about it next month, so I may be getting it wrong, but she talks about the word authentic. And in the context of race, and she's a black woman, and she talks about authenticity in the context of race, in which we think when we hear that word, in authenticity in the context of race, we think of sort of conformity, like a conforming to a narrative about the way a race, white or black, should be, white, black or brown should be. And she turns it and she says, actually, if you do something authentic, then you break the stereotype. So now that authenticity means something new. It doesn't mean something old. It means something new. So she's like twisted the meaning of authenticity in the context of racial narratives to mean something almost completely different. And I think that's what you're kind of getting at as to how we can use existing language to sort of talk about things in a different way. Is that right?
Yeah. I think that we use, if we continue to use the same language we've been using, there's already these traps, these traps of like, but I have something to say about what you just said. It's fascinating, by the way, and I'll definitely listen next week. But I guess what I'm trying to say in terms of changing our language is that we have to be able to approach people so that they can engage with the thing without necessarily – they can engage with the practice without necessarily being part of the organization, if that makes sense.
Exactly. And you know, maybe it's some of the most human and uplifting – instances of popular education that has ever happened in my life, and one of them actually happened today, that has ever happened in my life happened outside any sort of realm of organizational, any sort of real realm of organizational things. And it was just, I mean, today it was me and three other working class guys, two from the South and two from New York, just sitting around on my front porch talking about our lives. And to me, where the radical revolutionary language comes from is us working out how we see what's happening to us and how we see what's happening to others. And it's got to be in that dialogic process that like Paulo Freire talks about. It's got to happen in that process.
I was thinking about the word alternative. But like I kept thinking about like alternative, like, and then I kept thinking about nationalism I started going off on that kind of like, I wonder, like, there's so many words like that are just fascinatingly insidious, you know? That's how it works though, right? Like that's how fascists work in their language and stuff. They, like, for instance, Dugin translates one thing into Russian and one thing into English, and it's the same news story supposedly, but it's different ideologies.
We'll do this last. This is a question I ask everybody. If you come on our When the World is on Fire podcast, you get asked this question to wrap up, and it is, what is your hope and vision for the future?
A network series of autonomous communities capable of defense to act as a canopy against the collapse of empire that will either come from environmental collapse or the people of the working class standing up and making it obsolete. And I think that the vision for the future is that we have clean air and arable land for our next generation and for generations to come.
That's awesome. I think you have had the most specific hope and vision for the future of any of our guests thus far. You definitely know what you're fighting for, and I salute you for that. So, Jay, I want to tell you how much I very much appreciate you coming on and talking with me about your work and your life, and I appreciate you being vulnerable with me. You know, I really appreciate it. I wish you good luck in the work that you do, and I will follow you on Facebook.
Well, thank you very much, man. It was awesome.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for the work you do.
Yep. So before we wrap up, we still need a sponsor for this podcast. It's $39.99 a month. We'll talk about you on the show. We'll give you some free advertising on the show anytime you want to. We need people to help us get the word out about it, and we need a sponsor. So if you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on the Young Patriots Organization Birmingham, Confessions of a Mad Redneck, the Cooperative News School for Urban Studies and Environmental Justice, or just Zach Kenton on Facebook and the Mad Redneck on Twitter. So if y'all are interested, if anybody is interested in sponsoring or just want to talk with us, please get in touch with us. And we will see y'all next month.
did I struggle for right? Not for security alone do I fight, but the freedom to be whatever you might be. If we live in socialism and not slavery, I am a young patriot and I have a creed. I believe in others because we have believed. Not in the rights of rulers, but humanity. To be healthy and happy and to be free. Young patriot, a term I define. Not a matter of age, but a state of mind. And if you love freedom for liberty, you can join the young patriots and fight for it there.